give us the ballot, and we will fill our legislative halls with men of goodwill, and send to the sacred halls of Congress men who will not sign a Southern manifesto because of their devotion to the manifesto of justice. Give us the ballot, and we will place judges on the benches of the South who will do justly and love mercy. We will place at the head of the Southern states governors who have felt not only the tang of the human, but the glow of the divine. Give us the ballot, and we will quietly and nonviolently, without rancor or bitterness, implement the Supreme Court's decision of May 17, 1954.
Dr. King gave this speech at the Lincoln Memorial in 1957, years after the Supreme Court ruled that racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. But as to be expected in a country where racism is so deeply entrenched and systematic, that wasn't the end of the story. One well-intentioned mandate wouldn't be enough to change the hearts and minds of virulent racists, not even one handed down by the nation's highest court. Integration was met with resistance, and that resistance was often violent. And the separate but equal model persisted. And as King himself later said, justice too long delayed is justice denied. That was the case with voting rights, too. Black people had gotten the right to vote, but in practice, it was impossible for many to participate in a political system they supposedly had the right to, thanks to very real obstacles like literacy tests and poll taxes. In a swift blow of the hammer of institutional racism, white Americans proved that just because we were able to vote didn't mean we could vote. In the years after this speech, Black people would see their voice in the political process grow louder. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed, and the 24th Amendment was ratified. Poll taxes were banned. But if you've learned anything from the Civil Rights era, it's that the work never ends. That brings us to today. Yes, we're still up against some shady and harmful practices, like gerrymandering and voter ID laws. But our hard-won right to vote was just the beginning. Now we're making sure we have a seat at the table. I'm Bridget Todd, and you're listening to Afropunk Solution Sessions, changing the world one talk at a time. Afropunk is a safe place, a blank space to freak out in and to construct a new reality, to live our lives as we see fit, while making sense of the world around us. Here at Afropunk, we have the conversations that matter to us. And these are our solutions. I've been stranded, a bit to die on the side of the road. I've been shot just because my heart, I lost the ties, I've been body and soul. I've been a victim of golden eyes, I see the dead walk among the living. If you're anything like me, you've spent a generation hearing about the importance of our participation in the political system. I grew up hearing that the key to equality lies in Black folks flexing our electoral political muscles, paying attention to elections, voting, running for office. But not everyone has had that same experience. Eves Jeffcoat, our co-host, who you'll hear more from later, has been frustrated with how slowly the wheels of democracy turn.
Yeah. Although society told me voting was important, I wasn't really nudged or motivated to vote, even though I do. It's hard to keep voting, you know, a right our ancestors fought so hard to get, and see only some of what you'd hope for come to fruition. Gaining justice a little bit at a time after years of massive inequity. Story of our lives, right? But I realized that when it comes to political office, there aren't enough people there on our team to get more of that work done. And there's no reason that can't change, and is changing.
Right now, a lot of folks are saying that change should look like running for office. But what really goes into the decision to run for office? And with so many feeling understandably disenchanted with politics altogether, is it really the secret to getting free?
This is the story of that day.
MLK believed in the power of the Black vote to achieve Black liberation. But today, it seems like even if we do vote, we're participating in a system that wasn't actually set up to meet our needs. And that's a problem.
solution session. So I want to start out by telling you the problem that we have, because we have some serious problems when thinking about Black political power in this country. We are in a political crisis. In the 2016 election cycle, $1.3 billion were spent on engaging voters. Less than 5% of that were spent on Black people.
That's Jessica Byrd. She runs 3-Point Strategies, a firm of Black women political operatives who work with the Movement for Black Lives to elect Black radical candidates to achieve electoral justice. Or as she would say,
we are a firm entirely made up of Black women political operatives who are working every single day to fuck shit up.
Jessica believes in the power of electoral politics to make change in the lives of Black folks. But she's also honest about the fact that electoral politics hasn't always meaningfully engaged young folks of color.
And when mapping that out, which you can because public finance is a real thing, most of that money flowed to Black communities in the last month of the election. Do you want to be talked to late? Or do you want to have a real conversation with the people who want your vote? Overall, millennial turnout increased in 2016, but young Black people, our vote turnout decreased. We felt less and less that people were talking to us and that we could see ourselves in our government. Almost 10% of the Black electorate is disenfranchised because of our racist voter systems. So not only are our people who are locked inside, who are in cages, not able to vote, but there are voting systems that are intentionally keeping us from making our voices heard. 90% of the elected leaders in this country are white. Only 5% of elected leaders are Black people. 65% of elected leaders are men.
Part of Jessica's work involves mapping out who holds political power in different states and working to ensure that the people who hold that power look like the communities they're representing, also known as a reflective democracy. But in Georgia, there's still a long way to go.
So when done on a power index, that means that white men have almost 10 times the amount of political power as anybody else. Does that make sense? Does that reflect this specific room? Do you think we can change that? Obviously, absolutely.
Jessica is from Ohio, where she grew up poor. When she speaks, she talks about her brothers who work in factories. Her brothers, she explains, work alongside people who voted for Donald Trump, and in doing so, voted against their own lives and the lives of other people on the factory line.
You were a lifelong Democrat.
Yes.
And you're wearing a Trump shirt. How'd that happen?
If he does half of what he says he's going to do, it's a boost in the right direction. You can only go forward with him. I don't think you can go backwards. And sure as heck can't stay the same.
You've lost faith with the Democratic Party?
Yes.
She says growing up poor and Black made her feel like she didn't even have the right to be engaged in the political process, and like she wasn't allowed to ask questions of the people in power.
I mean, I felt shame a lot of times throughout my life, but the story that I would tell is, you know, I grew up really, really poor, working poor in Columbus, Ohio, and we lived in a predominantly Black working poor neighborhood. And it really influenced the way that I felt like I was allowed to ask questions about political power in my community. Because I always felt like I didn't have enough information and that for some reason, there was something baked into the DNA of my family that made it so that we didn't work hard enough to get things that like other people who had political power needed. I worked on my very first campaign though when I was 17, going to a high school that was honestly just crumbling and we were sharing it with an elementary school and so it was completely overcrowded. And if you can imagine being an 18-year-old going to school with like a third grader, there were some very real problems and I was always talking about this to my mom. And she was like, you need to show up to your state legislator's office. Again, super poor. The reason I know how to do Auntie Chic is because I was in those thrift stores styling. And I went to my very first state legislative campaign, and I learned exactly what it meant to lead a campaign, which is to take the number of people in your community and the amount of votes that you need to win, essentially produce a formula and go knock on doors and ask those people to be involved. And I became obsessed with this idea that even though I was poor, even though I was black, even though both of my parents died before the age of 27, that like I actually had a right to ask questions of the people who were leading me. I would say that even now, as I think about the way that people respond to me about political power, it isn't that we don't want to be involved at all. It's often that we don't have enough information. And so we feel like that's not our right to ask questions. What I want to say to you is to completely destigmatize this idea that you're supposed to have some answer. Those answers are being intentionally kept from us through a racist, sexist political system that was designed so that our voices weren't heard. So anything that you don't know about the political system is one, either a Google away, and also your God-given right by either being born in this country or paying fucking taxes. And so you deserve to be asking questions about who represents you.
Right. Who represents you? Think of that question. Who actually represents you politically? If you're Mary Pat Hector, the answer to that question is that no one represents you. So you do what she did. You represent yourself. We'll hear from her after this break. And we're back. Here's Mary Pat Hector at Solution Sessions in Atlanta.
She's so loud, angry, arrogant, bitchy. Who does she think she is? And what is she wearing? I mean, she's just asking for it. She has the audacity to think outside the box and be more than what we expect her to be. These are things women of color have heard since the beginning of time. But these are the things that I refused to assimilate to. That's why, at the age of 19 years old, I became the youngest woman and person of color in the state of Georgia to run for office.
While she was a sophomore at Spelman College, Mary Pat fought for the right to run for elected office. She says she was fueled by anger at watching Trump win the presidential election.
I can remember it like it was yesterday, standing side by side with my Spelman sisters as we heard the words, Donald J. Trump, President of the United States of America. Mad about the disturbing race relations in our country, bitter at the fact that as a woman, my reproductive rights were in the hands of a man, pissed that so many of my peers believed that by protesting their vote, it was the only way. But while so many people didn't know what to do or how to feel, millennials had this crazy idea of a power shift, a political power shift. Young people all over the country running for office to bring about progressive change. And of course, we were met with opposition. I was the most qualified person in my race. Young people began making calls, campaigning. College students from all over the country were sending funds to support our efforts. On January 20th, I received a call stating that my 71-year-old opponent felt that I was just too young to run against him or for any other elected position. But surely I was old enough. I mean, I was old enough to vote. I was old enough to fight for this country. I was old enough to pay taxes. Men said things to me such as, I think it's cute that you're running for office, but public office isn't a cute matter. As we knocked on doors, women said things like, wait your turn. What does that mean? Adults and elders that I saw each morning that greeted me with a smile began to criminalize me and thought that it was just wrong that I refused to assimilate to their expectations as me as a 19-year-old student. We ended up fighting for us to stay on the ballot because our campaign wasn't run off the premise of us being young, but off the fact that we wanted to see change in our community.
Like Jessica, Mary Pat got interested in activism after getting angry by the things she saw around her. She was 11 when she organized her first sit-in, a response that was rooted in simmering frustration around being treated like an outsider in her own community. I was wondering, could you tell me a bit about that? You know, most 11-year-olds are not leading sit-ins. What made you feel like that was something that you wanted to do at such a young age?
So growing up in Stone Mountain, Georgia specifically, a lot of people that I knew were turning to, like, gun violence is the answer, or, like, violence. My best friend at the time ended up getting pregnant, and I realized, like, either people are dying shooting people or they're getting pregnant. And I felt like no one really cared about the community. There was nothing for us to do after school but, of course, get into trouble or potentially have intercourse and end up like my best friend and be pregnant. And so I felt like no one was really looking out for the young people within my community, and they only saw us as problems instead of assets. And I felt like something needed to be done or changed about it. There were several mega churches, Georgia's known for mega churches, within our community that could have opened their doors. Instead, they had signs in the yard that said, young people, please don't walk on our grass. And so that was the community that we pretty much lived in. And so I decided to have a sit-in to bring awareness to the violence happening within our community and the fact that we needed a teen center. And that day, I actually got involved in National Action Network, which is an organization founded by Reverend Al Sharpton, which I now lead the Youth Division for. I think about it now, like that, how long ago that was for me and how that day pretty much changed my life. But then I also think about the people who were there with me that day, like one of my best friends, Tanisha, or my friend Taifiq, who are both now gone and who were both killed. And I think about how ever since then we were fighting for a way out, and I'm happy to see that myself and a few others were able to make it out, but some weren't as fortunate. But I think just moments like what happened when I was 11 years old and that very first sit-in are things that pretty much fuel my fire today and really encourage me to keep going.
Mary Pat's motto is, you don't have to wait to be great. You can change the world now. She thinks the answer to building political power and actually making a difference is more young people of color feeling empowered to run for public office, and not just expecting the old guards of political power to have our best interests at heart.
I think that too many times we look for people who have been in this realm to make a difference. I'm sorry, but if a person who has been in Congress for 35 to 45 years and we're still asking them to make a difference, it's true that they just can't do it, but that doesn't mean that you can't run against this person, take their position, and make a change. If we encourage Samantha, if we encourage Jonathan, Justin, Mary Pat, I don't know, like, to run for this position, to run against people 3-4 times their senior, and encourage them to run for office, then maybe we will see a difference if they win, and, like, have someone in these positions of power really advancing our people. But I feel like we've just gotten too comfortable, and the people that we've allowed to remain in these positions have gotten too comfortable for too long.
Mary Pat is upbeat, but she's clear that running for office involves getting out of those comfort zones. She says it's difficult and sometimes lonely work. She mobilized a coalition of active supporters, mostly other young people, who donated money to her campaign and helped her knock doors to get out the vote. She is gracious, but sounds genuinely exhausted with looking back on her city council race.
During that entire process, I felt alone. And I felt like I was by myself. And like, I feel like Dr. Martin Luther King probably felt the same way. Rosa Parks probably felt the same way. Harriet Tubman probably felt the same way. I felt alone throughout that entire process of my life. And I didn't see the bigger picture until it was all over. And I was able to see the difference in which it made. And so while you may feel alone, while you may feel like no one understands, while you may feel like you really want to give up, you can't. Because you have to see, realize, and understand the bigger picture. Seeing my 11-year-old brother, who I want to be able to walk to a store with a hoodie without being shot or stopped and killed by a police officer, that makes me push through. You know, seeing my 80-year-old grandfather, who became the first African-American worker at Wright-Patterson Air Force in Mississippi, see how proud he is about the different things that I'm doing. And like, he talks to me about how, you know, he used to march and how he used to resist in places like Mississippi and how proud he is of me and how I have all of these cousins and all of these nieces and nephews looking at me because I'm the only person in my family who's just involved in this work, and they say, like, I want to do what you're doing and I want to be more involved. And how can I? That makes me push through.
We'll be back with more Afropunk Solution Sessions after another quick break.
Tremendous potential. I've gotten to know our country so well. Tremendous potential. It's going to be a beautiful thing. Every single American will have the opportunity to realize his or her fullest potential. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
Do you remember how you felt when you woke up the morning of November 9th, 2016? Maybe you felt panicked. Maybe you felt empty and numb. Or maybe you just felt angry. Both Mary Pat and Jessica talk about how that anger drove them to get more involved in politics. They aren't alone. Muthoni Wambu Kral works for Emily's List, an organization that supports and trains women to run for office. She says after the election, a wave of pissed-off women of all ages decided to do exactly what Mary Pat did. They decided they wanted to run for office. These women, fueled by a righteous anger, flooded the Emily's List website. At the time, the site didn't even have an easy-to-find sign-up form to get trained. But these women found it, as if they were all following the same North Star. So I've actually heard folks at Emily's List repeat this anecdote a lot. When you think about it, it's actually kind of hard to find a page on a website that isn't super public-facing. That meant these angry women really had to want to hunt this down.
Yeah, they put a lot of work into it. You can tell that there was some sort of force of magnetism that was really drawing them to take this political action that they may not have thought about before at all in the least bit. So they were really galvanized. So I asked Muthoni about this surge of women who were really eager to take action and how that coincided with the presidential election and the Me Too movement.
We are seeing a time where after the election of Donald Trump, we weren't even a month later when we discovered over 1,000 names of women who had found some little remote part of our website and signed up on a form that, frankly, we're embarrassed to say we didn't even realize was still up on our website, and saying that they were interested in learning how to run for office. And we realized that we had most definitely entered a new age, and it was clearly parallel to how women were feeling after Hillary Clinton's defeat and after the election of Donald Trump.
It turns out, anger is a pretty good motivator. Anger drove these women, who don't look anything like the people who traditionally hold power in politics, to want to make change.
We are smart and we have skills.
We are smart and we have skills.
If Trump don't do it, the women will.
If Trump don't do it, the women will. Hey.
What are some of the motivators, both personal and social, that you think are compelling women of color to run who maybe haven't thought about it before or don't come from a political or an activist background?
We've often said that women run for office because they are angry or they want to fix something. And this is, I mean, everything that is happening right now has just bubbled to the surface. There is a lot of frustration. And I think that there's been a lot of infrastructure building that has been happening in movements that has sort of met this moment at just the right time.
Like Mary Pat and Jessica, Muthoni wants people to see that if they're angry and they want to make change, they don't have to wait until someone gives them permission to run for office. You're probably more qualified than you think.
So many of us underestimate what experience really means and what experience is actually needed when we look at running for elected office, because there are so many of these jobs that, frankly, none of us even know exist as an elected office. It is incredibly overwhelming for a lot of folks and or discouraging to sort of see themselves as a potential candidate for elected office, quote unquote.
Muthoni is one of those people you can just tell was raised by educators. Like Mary Pat and Jessica, she was encouraged to be more involved in politics at an early age. She calls herself a movement child. But not everyone has had this upbringing. Muthoni says some marginalized people feel shame at not knowing enough about the political system, and that shame drives them to disconnect from politics entirely.
Muthoni told me that when people check out of politics, it doesn't stop politics from being something that impacts their lives. She actually shared a great quote on the subject.
It's one that Maya Annalis, who is a former state senator in Illinois, used to say, and that is, if you do not do politics, politics will still be done to you. There is something so important about all of us in some way figuring out how we get more engaged. And whether that is running for office or helping more good people to run, and therefore having some impact on the people who have an impact on you, is critically, critically important. And I don't, you know, put all this blame on us. There is something that has been really by design in this country around leaving people in a state of struggle that has oftentimes led to a lot of the disconnect and impacted participation numbers, et cetera. But I think we are again seeing communities rounding a corner. There is more self-organizing going on, and it's not just been inside of the women's community. It's not just after these marches. It has been happening after too many of our young people, you know, have suffered at the hands of the police. It has been happening inside of these dreamer communities. This is what Emily Sosa has been doing for 30 years. It's been this slow buildup to this moment. And again, I think we're kind of at a moment right now where we are all realizing the danger of handing over this much of our power for somebody else to make a ton of decisions around. And not having a little bit more of our brains and our hands inside of what is happening from the community level up.
It's probably not very difficult to imagine how growing up poor would make someone check out of politics. But for Jessica and Mary Pat, growing up poor only drove them to be more invested in shaping and understanding the power dynamics unfolding around them. And when people who have been left out of political conversations become the ones who are making decisions, well, that's when we start to see real change.
I grew up poor in Mississippi. I'm fairly certain there's a country song or blues song about that.
That's Stacey Abrams. Remember her name, because you'll probably be hearing it again. We talked about her historic campaign, which, if she wins, will make her the country's first Black female governor. Let that sink in for a moment.
I spend a lot of time talking about decriminalization of poverty, because unless you've been poor, you do not always understand what it means to have your license taken away because you can't pay a traffic ticket. Because the minute that happens, you can't get to work anymore. And the job you have that's barely helping you make ends meet disappears. If you are a person of color who has experienced discrimination, then you have the ability often to see where discrimination lies and to then counteract it. You need diversity because diversity provides information. It also provides ways to address issues. And that diversity in and of itself creates a richer and fuller response in politics.
For Stacey, running for office isn't just about her. It's about making sure leaders in government aren't all the same, so they can actually have a chance to understand the lived experiences of their constituents.
Why does representation and diversity matter in government?
We have seen what happens when you have a homogeneous set of people making decisions. too many people are left out of those choices. Too many people are impacted negatively by the decisions that are made. And it isn't until we add new voices, add new people of color, add women, add differences based on sexual orientation, that we then become aware of the impediments and the prejudices that exist in our communities and in our policies. And so I see diversity as the only way to get to good answers, because otherwise you're trying to solve a problem without full information. And that's both intellectually void, but it also is immoral, because you are not serving everyone, and that is the responsibility of good government.
Understandably, many people feel strongly about how ineffective and deceitful our current political system is. And we'll talk to some of them next. At Afropunk Atlanta, Corey Oliver talked to young Black people about their feelings around voting. Marissa was one of them.
Do you vote?
I do vote.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's important for Black people?
I vote because I want to make sure that I support all the efforts. Like, if there is a cause and you're asking me, if you're saying you believe that if I vote, this will make a change, then I'm going to help you do that. I'm not going to negate it. I don't necessarily believe in it. But yeah, I'll show up to vote. You're asking me to do something very simple. I can do that. I just feel that there are systems in place that everyone is aware of. However, they're not being fixed or attended to, and they haven't been for years. And I just feel like it's a false narrative to continue to ask people to participate in a political process that's not supporting their community. And it's so blatant, it's so disgusting. It's hard to really trust that me voting is really the thing that's gonna make the difference, because clearly something's askew. And I don't believe that bureaucracy is necessarily the way to fix it.
Everybody I know say they too broke to vote. And with all this heavy slave mentality, we could have broke the boat. Nobody cares about me. Nobody cares about my family. Nobody cares about my folks. And nobody gets my vote. Nobody for president. That's my campaign slogan.
Stacey Abrams gets this sentiment. She says it's a failure of leadership to meaningfully reflect the people they serve.
Too many people don't see themselves reflected in leadership. They don't see themselves or hear themselves reflected in the conversations around them. And this is not just for Georgia, this is nationally. And because of that, too often we limit what our capacity is.
I believe we ought to do all we can and seek to lift ourselves by our own bootstraps. But it's a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And many Negroes, by the thousands and millions, have been left bootless as a result of all of these years of oppression and as a result of a society that deliberately made his color a stigma and something worthless and degrading.
When MLK was murdered, he was organizing the Poor People's Campaign, a campaign that would unite the country's poor for a new march on Washington to demand better. Better jobs. Better homes. Better education. Better lives than the ones they were living. As much as he championed voting as a means of political power, he clearly understood that it was about more than power at the ballots. It was about the right to demand better, not just from our democratic system, but for ourselves. We deserve representatives who look like us and understand our stories. And if we can't find those representatives, isn't there power in taking on that mantle ourselves, like Mary Pat did? Or as Jessica puts it,
we recognize that voting alone will not change the conditions plaguing Black communities, but we believe that Black people deserve a loving and strategic political home to seek transformative political change. Does that sound all right?
Yeah. Solution Sessions envisions this home through talks with our most celebrated thinkers and dialogue with members of the Afropunk community who are motivated to make a difference. Join us and let's create the change we want to see with real-world solutions.
What's the solution, Bridget?
Do your research.
What's the solution, Bridget?
Find motivation in anger.
What's the solution, Bridget?
There's more to building power than voting.
What's the solution, Bridget?
Fight back. Be sure to join us next week for another deep dive into the other Black experience.
I liked Obama because he was a brother that gave a lot of racist old white men, you know, heart palpitations. Because he had a brother in the White House and he was smooth. But he was still the president of the United States. Did I ever think for a second he was really going to precipitate change? No. So on a symbolic level, I love that. But, you know, when I'm walking down 125th Street and I see murals with MLK, Malcolm X, and Obama, there's a disconnect between the 1960s and now. And, you know, the name of that goal, for lack of a better term, is neoliberalism.
Afropunk Solution Sessions is a co-production between Afropunk and How Stuff Works. Your hosts are Bridget Todd and Eves Jeffcoat. Executive co-producers are Julie Douglas, Jocelyn Cooper, and Quan Latif Hill. Dylan Fagan is supervising producer and Kathleen Quillian is audio engineer. Many, many thanks to Casey Pegram and Annie Reese for their production and editorial oversight. And many thanks to our on-the-ground Atlanta crew, Ben Bolin, Corey Oliver, and Noel Brown. The Underside of Power is performed by Algiers. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Afropunk.